All right. So homework three is due on Monday, anytime Monday. I know a number of you have gotten started, so hopefully everyone is doing pretty good with it so far. I know it's a long way out, but our final, they gave us a tentative date of like May 7th. It's like the last Monday of finals week, which is way out there. So I'm trying to get it changed because I think that's too far. Like the last day of class is like April 23rd. And having the final, like May 7th, I think it was, it's just, to me, that's like 2 weeks. It's way too far. And I assume that a number of you might have internships, or you might have other things going on that summer, so you'd rather get done sooner. So I'm going to try to get us a room for an earlier date. I'll keep you guys posted. Let's see. I think that's really it in the way of announcements. We'll have our first student presentations this Monday. It'll be Christian and Peter. We'll be talking on PICS and other topics and spatial data structures. So today I want to go through the rest of the graphics pipeline. I think we'll probably finish it today. Certainly I'm not in a rush. And if we finish early, I'll start talking about the course project. But if not, we'll wait to Monday, which is where it's scheduled for. So when we look at the graphics pipeline, right, we've said that we have some scene description that's a bunch of triangles, some materials, some lights in that scene, and a camera, right? And then we're trying to create, from that 3D scene, we're trying to create a 2D image. And we walked through a good bit of the pipeline on Monday, where we looked at vertex assembly, where we said we might have data in multiple buffers, how do we assemble a single vertex from that. And then we go through a vertex shader, which transforms it from an individual position from model to clip coordinates. Then we did primitive assembly, where we reconstructed from those primitive, from this triangle, or excuse me, from those vertices, the actual primitives, which are, in most cases, are triangles. So now we have a bunch of transformed triangles that were potentially moved as well during vertex shading for like an animation effect, like the pulsing we looked at. And now we're talking about, well, how do we get fragments? How do we get pixels from those triangles? And then we'll eventually shade them and wind up with our 3D image. So we said the actual process of rasterization was given this 2D triangle that's on the screen, how do we figure out what pixels it overlaps? Right, and we said a naive way to do this was with flood fill, recursive flood fill, where you find one pixel inside the triangle, then you recurse in every direction, both X and Y, until you find the edges. And that's kind of naive, and as far as I know, that's not done in practice at all. Then we also said there's scanline algorithms where you can kind of go from left to right or any direction that you want and find out when you're inside or outside the triangle. Another thing that we'll see, which I believe is the most common thing done in hardware, is they rasterize it in a hierarchical fashion. So here I'll draw part of the frame buffer. And here's our triangle. What they'll do is first they'll get a quad and they'll say, okay, does this triangle overlap this quad? Yes. If it does, then they'll break the quad up into four and they'll say, okay, does each of these quads overlap? And if one doesn't, they'll throw it away. And then they'll continue to subdivide. So like in this case, you'd throw away these three guys. So it's really fast, like hierarchical way to do rasterization. If you, for your project, do an alternative rendering pipeline, like for example, you implement your own graphics pipeline in CUDA, which would be an awesome project, experimenting with different ways to do rasterization would be like a really like good cutting edge kind of topic. Because we feel that with CUDA and OpenCL that you'll see a new era of graphics research being done because now it's so accessible for you or I to play with rasterization routines that are hardware accelerated, that are on the GPU as opposed to doing something on the CPU. And then there's a whole world in terms of rasterization on does part of the triangle actually cover a pixel? You know, if it's completely covered, that's one thing. If it's completely not covered, that's another thing, right? But then you have these cases where part of the triangle covers part of a pixel. And we'll have a whole student presentation on anti-aliasing to determine about how do you deal with that. Because, you know, you might say, okay, it's just the center point, and you might wind up with some jaggy edges. Or you might do multi-sampling where you pick four points. And in this case, two of the four points are in that triangle, so you might blend it and say, okay, that the opacity here is 50%, and you'll get something smoother. But then you might say that these regular patterns here they create artifacts, so you might actually rotate those patterns within a pixel, and so on. There's a whole anti-aliasing is a huge topic in itself. You won't, you know, don't feel responsible for it now, but we will have a student presentation later in the semester on it. So rasterization, not only does it take the positions and then create fragments or pixels, right, but any other per-vertex data, like, for example, your normals or color, it will interpolate those over the triangle. So, you know, say we have one triangle, and let's just make it simple. Just say we have temperature values. So, you know, over here is 95, over here is 60, over here is 130. So each of these fragments here that are created from rasterization, this will be a linear combination of the three surrounding values. And as you can imagine, this one's going to be pretty close to 95. This one will be pretty close to 130, and so on. And this is usually based on the barycentric coordinates. Yeah?
This is slightly aside, but so presumably this is something that's hardware accelerated.
Absolutely. Right? This will, and so, we haven't been talking about that yet, but later today we'll see it. Yes, this is an
aspect. So my question is, back when there wasn't such thing as CUDA and sort of GPGP stuff had to be hacked and shaders and stuff, did this present a problem where you would give the GPU a bunch of data to process and then they would attempt to interpolate between data points?
So this, actually, a lot of times this was seen as a strength, where they go, people would go, oh, I get linear interpolation or bilinear interpolation for free. So they would actually want this a lot. Now, in most versions of OpenGL and GLSL, you can actually turn this off. It does this interpolation by default, but there's a keyword you could call it flat. And if you say flat, then it will not do the interpolation. And sometimes that's useful. Let's see. Yeah, that's about it. So just know that anything that your vertex shader outputs will go through the rasterization stage and you'll get interpolated values. If you have normals here, say N0, you know, N1 and N2, and say these are of unit length, after interpolation, your normal, say then now you have some normal, you know, N whatever, NX. This normal is not guaranteed to be normalized, which means that if you're going to do lighting computations with it, you're going to wind up wanting to normalize it before you use it in the fragment shader. And we'll go over that when we actually start looking at the code. But that's probably the most common gotcha when it comes to the interpolation that's done during rasterization. Okay, so one question I have for you guys is, tell me what you think about, in a typical scene, or maybe in an atypical scene, the workload differences between number of triangles and number of fragments produced. You know, like, how many triangles are going to come in, how many fragments are typically going to come out. Do you think this is a regular workload, is a balanced workload? What do you think? Put you on the spot.
I'm thinking of examples in like gaming where it's like, I know like old N64 games have like relatively light polygons but have fairly high.
That is a great segue into like 30 slides from there. But yeah, so go ahead. If I have a really big triangle, that's one triangle that's going to create how many fragments? A lot is a good answer. We don't need exact numbers, but you may wind up in a lot of cases where you have many more fragments than you do triangles, right? So you might have, you know, on the order of today's games, yeah, I don't know, you might have hundreds of thousands of triangles, but millions of fragments. Now, of course, you can imagine situations where maybe if the viewer is zoomed right way out, where you have these really small triangles. And they turn out to be inefficient for a number of other reasons. But typically, you'll have one of a lot more fragments than you will primitives. So do you guys have any questions on rasterization? Okay, so after we get all these fragments from rasterization, we go through fragment shading. And this is really where we do where we create color. We take the materials, we take, you know, whatever the material is for that particular fragment and whatever lights are in the scene, and we simulate their interaction to create color. This is also called a pixel shader in Direct3D. I really don't like that term, though, because these aren't guaranteed to be pixels. These could fail the depth test and never be written to the frame buffer, in which case they're never going to become a pixel. So fragment shader is like a more precise term. However, we will look at a number of techniques to minimize the number of fragments that are shaded but not written to the depth buffer, because that would be wasted work. I think on the first day, one of the first days of class, I drew that scene with all the spheres lined up, right? And I said only the front pixel needed to be shaded. Okay, so when we look at the fragment shader, you have a fragment coming in, right? And I mean, what does that mean? That is an X and Y coordinate in screen space, and also the Z coordinate that we got from the viewport transform, which is going to be typically in the range 0 to 1, and I'll show you guys exactly how we deal with that. But you had the X and Y for the fragment, and then you had any other data that was interpolated during rasterization, you know, like I say, temperature, normals, anything of that nature. And then just like the vertex shader can have uniform data coming in, we can also have uniform data coming into the fragment shader. And textures as well, just like we looked at the textures for doing displacement mapping in a vertex shader. So what kind of uniforms do you think would be useful to input into a vertex or a fragment shader? Yep?
You need the matrices, like the view of worlds.
So for a vertex shader, we definitely always want those. Sometimes even in a fragment shader, I might want those. For example, I was doing some procedural shading work, and I wanted to take my particular fragment and then back it out into model coordinates. And for that, I needed one of those matrices. But what other uniforms do you think are useful, especially when you think that we're trying to do lighting? Right? So think about just the lights in your scene. They might all come in as uniforms. You know, this light is in this position. You know, this light points this direction, and so on. But really, anything that you need that can be the same for a number of fragments can come in as uniforms. Textures, this can be anything. The most common example, I'm not sure if it's coming up in a little bit, but it's just I want to slap an image on a piece of geometry on a model, and that image comes in as a texture. But we use textures for a number of other things that aren't just straight up color related. Okay, so I want to quickly show you some small code examples for what might be one of the most common things you do in a fragment shader, which is, here I'll show the Blin Fong lighting model. You probably saw at least the Fong lighting model in Norm's class. Did you guys see Blin Fong as well? It's very similar, just changes one of the dot products. But here, this is a very simple approximation to do lighting. It is, a lot of people say it looks like plastic. I definitely remember that when I was in 460 Norm. Keep going, oh, it looks like plastic. Because it turns out when you look at the BRDS, which are kind of like the underlying physics for it, that it actually approximates plastic. Although when they did this at the time, I don't know if they necessarily knew they were doing that. But we break the lighting down into a few major components. One is a diffuse component. And a diffuse surface is kind of rough. It scatters light like in all directions. Like this surface right here on this board, this is pretty diffuse. This chalkboard probably, that's a little reflective. Maybe the tops of your desks are also considered diffuse. And this can be very efficiently computed here, where I'm showing one pixel there, P, with a normal that we got coming into the fragment shader through interpolation. And then I have a vector to the light source, and the light position, you can imagine, that was passed in as a uniform, but the vector to the light, that would be computed per fragment. And here, I'm taking the dot product of N and L, right? And that, I mean, that's all that really is the dot product. And remember, the dot product for unit vectors is the same as cosine, right? This is 90 and 180. Definitely memorize if you haven't already. The graph for cosine. But here, say here's the pixel we're shading, there's the normal, here's the vector to the light. All this says is if the light source is pointing straight down, the intensity is at its highest. It's 1. Okay? As this light comes off to the side, cosine goes towards 0. Right? So all it's saying is that if the surface is oriented so the light is facing directly at it, you get the most amount of intensity. As that angle decreases, you'll get less intensity. And that's it. So it's one line of code. The max there is for if the light is on the other side of, you know, if it's underneath the surface. So now we're just saying there's no intensity, there's no lighting there, 0. However, you might have open objects. Like think of a box, you know, a cube, and you took off the top of it. You might want to light it two different ways, or one for the inside and one for the outside. Or you might want to give it two different materials, one on the inside, one on the outside. And you would do that by, you know, a simple way to do this is to check the dot product here. Okay. So that's it. And this rings a bell, right, from 460 to Fuchs. Should be very, very familiar. Okay, so the next part of this is specular, right? And this is a shiny surface, almost, you know, think of a mirror reflection. And here it's slightly more involved, but it's still really just a dot product. So I'll show you what you probably have already seen before with the straight up Phong model, which is you have a, you can reflect this vector L around N. And I'll call that a reflected vector. So these two angles are the same. That's a great energy question, or it's a classic game programming interview. Has anyone asked how do you reflect a vector around another vector in an interview? No one? I think this is such a commonly known interview question that I personally don't use it anymore because I think it's so commonly known. The good news here, you know, if you're like scared of adding these two vectors and divided by 2 or something. It's not that hard, but GLSL has a reflect function, which is what we use in practice. But if you reflect this light vector around the normal, we get this reflected vector R. Now, let's just say we know where the viewer is, so we have another vector to the viewer. We care about this angle here. Now, here's why. If I have a really reflective surface, the light is most intense if the light is reflecting right into my eye, okay? And when it's reflecting right into my eye, the dot product here is 0, so it's 1. Okay, and as it reflects less and less into my eye, this approach is 0. All right, so this is the standard Phong model here. Now, the Blinn Phong that we're showing up there actually uses the half vector between V and L. Okay, so imagine adding them up and dividing by 2 and you get this half vector. And then it uses the dot of the half vector and the normal vector, which is an approximation of N dot V. Do you guys know why you might want to do this, the Blinn Phong model over the regular Phong model? It actually looks like it can be more instructions because it requires square root, but if you assume that this is a directional, for directional lights, you guys did directional lights before 60, right? You assume that that this vector is the same for all pixels. It's like the sun is so far away, you assume that its incident angle in every spot is the same vector. And you also put the viewer at infinity. So L and V become constant, so therefore H is constant. Right, so now you don't have to do this reflection vector for directional light sources. And I think there's some other benefits. But what I really want you guys to see is to do some basic lighting, it's just a couple of lines of code. You know, like if you go and you add lighting to a shader, and you will do that in your assignment, it's like, you know, add these three lines of code, and you're done for basic Phong lighting or Blinn Phong lighting.
And these are computed. What I'm showing you here is that they're computed per fragment in the fragment shader. Now, we could compute this data per vertex and let rasterization interpolate the colors. And why would I want to do that, or why would I not want to do that? Any intuition? Okay, so for performance, what do you think is better in the common case? So if I were to shade per vertex, do the same exact computations in the vertex shader, output them, output the color, and then just let interpolation interpolate those, it's probably going to be a lot faster because I probably have a lot less vertices than I do fragments. Okay, so for visual quality, what do you guys think?
Fragment shader
is better. Okay, so let's look at some examples here. Okay, so here you'll see the specular highlight, which is the shiny part here. Which one do you guys think is per fragment? Which one do you think is per vertex? It might actually be kind of hard to see in this picture. Left is vertex. I need to check my notes. I didn't even put my notes in here. I'm pretty sure that you're right, yes. Left is vertex. And you can see that because you can see the banding in it. Because you can see it. See, the specular highlight doesn't go as wide out. It's just very, very narrow. Now here, this example is a lot better. Here, we're doing per vertex lighting. But look how the tessellation impacts the specular highlight. Like here, it's highly tessellated. And you can really see what the specular highlight is. But out here, you can barely see. Right, so in fact, you can completely miss a specular highlight with per vertex light. And like, you know, like a pro tip in like the late 90s used to be, if you have specular lighting, that you should finely tessellate your geometry so it looks nice. Even if you had a planar wall, you would still tessellate it, keep it planar, just so you had more lighting computations going on. You know, so they're trying like to approximate per fragment lighting. Okay, so here's another. So that one example that we would do in the fragment shader is a simple Phong or Blinn Phong lighting model. Another example is texture mapping. Right? And on Monday we said part of a vertex might be a texture coordinate, just a 2D coordinate that is usually normalized between 0 and 1 that is input into an image. And when I say image, you know, think Photoshop image. And then those texture coordinates, they'll get interpolated during rasterization. And we can use them to read from an image and slap it on the model, right? So you have artists, and when they're producing the model, they have textures, and they do UV mapping. They assign those texture coordinates. There's other ways to assign texture coordinates, too. We can do it procedurally in code. And then in a fragment shader, you know, it's literally one line of code where you say, okay, my UV coordinate came in. Now read from this texture, and the texture kind of came in like a uniform did. This particular example here shows multiple images in the same texture. So you guys can see the wing and the body and all in this image. And we'll call that a texture atlas, where when you put more than one images in the same texture. And they have a lot of performance benefits because you don't have a bunch of separate textures, which will break batches, meaning you'd have to issue separate draw calls or think in CUDA, separate kernel invocations for each texture, but when you slam it all into one big texture, then you only have to invoke one kernel or one draw call. And we'll have a whole lot of talking on performance later in the semester, because like half of real-time rendering, or maybe I could even argue all of real-time rendering, is doing things fast. Like, you know, in offline, like, you know, we know how to render, or, you know, we really know how to do really good visual quality, and then real-time rendering is like, how can we get as close to that visual quality as possible and still make it really fast? So here's some screenshots maybe to help it hit home. So on the left-hand side, I have a globe or a sphere, and it's just lit. It's got diffuse lighting, and it's got specular and a specular highlight. And hopefully you can see that the light is kind of up here from the upper right, which you can tell by seeing the specular highlight. The middle one is just a texture map. Okay, that's just an image that I slapped on that geometry. Can you see how flat that it looks? Then the one on the right, I just multiplied the two values. And now you see you get color and you get shape. Okay, so something that you guys will implement for part of one of your homeworks is called bump mapping. And you'll notice now you're starting to see these globes and you start seeing my bias, right? I work on globe applications, so you start seeing my bias coming into the course. But let me show you these two screenshots next to each other. So here's a globe. Here's a globe with bump mapping. How do you guys think that's done?
Change the normal.
Right, so it looks like more geometry, right? You see all these little mountains? It looks like we tessellated that globe and we added a bunch more geometry. But he's exactly right. What we did here in the fragment shader is we passed in a texture that was not used for color, but instead it was actually a height map saying how high is terrain, you know, that part of the world. We read from that height map and we use that to change the normal for the lighting calculation. So we totally pretend that there's actual geometry there by lying about the normal. Instead of making the normal perpendicular to the surface, we made it perpendicular to what the terrain would be underneath it. Right, so like we rendered, you know, say the globe is flat, or we approximate it as flat. You think the normal is this, but since we read a height map data, we really changed the normal to be over here. And then that changed the lighting, and now you get those darkened spots. And this is called bump mapping. I'm pretty sure you guys did it in 460, and it's a really common technique used in graphics. That is not perfect because, as you can imagine, on the silhouette edges, on like the outside edge, you don't actually see the bumps of the terrain because there are no bumps. It's just flat. It's just a lighting trick. And you guys will get to implement this, which I think is really cool. This was something that was, don't let this scare you, this was extra credit last spring, but then we decided, and this was based on student feedback, that it was important enough that they thought it should have been part of the real assignment. So you guys will tell me if that's the right move or not, but I'm pretty sure it is. So just to sum up, I'm showing you guys really simple things that we can do in a fragment shader, a few lines of code. The reality is, when you look at games, you know, high-end games, fragment shaders are doing quite a bit of computation, right? And I know, you know, the first or second day of class I talked about, one example was skin rendering with subsurface scattering, where it's actually simulating multiple layers of skin that all have different properties and how the light goes in there and scatters. This particular example is called sum of Gaussians. And we have a whole student talk on skin rendering as well. So fragment shaders are typically the computationally expensive part of the pipeline. Not always, but if I had to make some blanket statement, it's on where can you improve performance, it's almost always going to be fragment shading. And I'll also show you techniques for how you figure out where the bottlenecks are. But just off the cuff, usually fragment shading is where all the heavy stuff is done. So we're saying that the output from fragment shading is a colored pixel. This fragment came in, it has a position on the screen, probably some other data that was interpolated on rasterization. We have some uniforms, maybe like textures and uniform and lights. And color comes out. But we can also output other things from a fragment shader. What do you guys think would be useful?
Depth.
Like, why would I want to output depth?
And you need it later to order your fragments.
Okay, so that Z value will help us figure out what's in front of what. What if I told you that by default, the depth is always just passed right through? But if you wanted to modify it in the fragment shader, you could, unless you're in WebGL right now, which really sucks. I'm hoping that we get that feature in soon. Why am I hoping that, though? Well, why would you want a fragment shader to be able to change the depth value of the fragment? You know, like at that point, you're like lying, right? We figured out the depth value during rasterization; it was interpolated, and we know how far it is from the viewer. And now you're going to say, okay, I want to write a fragment shader that's going to change that depth value. Right? Why would I want to do that?
You can't think of any reasons.
Can anyone think of any reasons? Okay, there are lots of. What?
Like you're making effects like lens.
Like a lens? Like I'm not sure that we would do that with changing depth in the fragment shader. What?
Make an effect.
Go ahead.
You mean so like the silhouette of an object that's behind something can go to the front? Like so you have a game where there's enemies behind a wall. Could you like
So, but why would we do that per fragment? I mean, why not just in the vertex shader just pull it forward, right? Or even in the model matrix before the vertex shader, why not just change the translation, right? So it seems like, man, like why would we want the fragment shader to write depth? I find myself wanting to do it now that I've been working in WebGL like all the time. And one of the most common reasons is I may render geometry, but not actually want that geometry to show up. So one simple example, probably the simplest example I can show you, is maybe I render, here's the viewer, and I rendered a box. But I don't want to actually show the box. Instead, in the fragment shader, I want to shoot a ray through each pixel that the box created, and then do like a ray shear intersection, and actually render the shear.
Bounded box.
It is inside the bounding box, yeah. And when I go to output this pixel, that fragment's depth is no longer the depth of the box, it's actually the depth that's behind it in the shear. You see along the ray? So a lot of times a fragment shader will do tricks like this and you'll want to change the depth value.
Is this the result of that? Is the result that you're just making
exactly. Yeah. And that has some benefits because that's just straight up ray casting or rasterization at that point. Because now you're only rendering one box, but you're getting a smooth shear. And as you zoom in, since the ray cast is per fragment, it's going to get smoother and smoother. And you'll see, I have some pictures coming up too for other examples. Okay, so we can also throw away the fragment too, meaning that we decide that we don't want to process it. We can go, okay, this fragment is not important. Let's get rid of it. You guys know why I'd want to do that? I just realized I have a good picture. I'm giving away like half of a discussion for later in the slides. But one example could be, you know, say I have a fence. We're playing a game. In fact, you'll notice this even on today's games. Say you're playing a game and there's a fence, a chain link fence. They're not going to model that with geometry. They're not going to model each link of the chain with geometry. Instead, it's going to be one long triangle or two triangles, depending on how much it curves, and they're going to slap a texture on that, where the texture, the image, is the chain, and it's going to have an alpha value of 0 where there's no change. So at that point in the fragment shader, you're going to want to be able to see through it. So you would say, hey, if my alpha is 0, discard it, get rid of it. Do you guys see that? So it's just kind of like a fake trick. And I have a picture of the slides. I should have put it sooner, but I'll remind you guys when we come up to it. And a fragment shader can also output not just one color, but we can output multiple colors. Again, unless you're in WebGL, which I'm hoping that extension comes through soon. And that can be useful for techniques where I'm saying we're not putting colors, but it's not actually colors. In fact, after spring break, we're going to look at a technique called deferred shading, where instead of doing this lighting during this normal part of the pipeline, we're going to pretend that lighting is a post-processing effect, just like a blur or a bloom or something along those lines that you do like in Photoshop, eye correction. And our fragment shader will output all of the information that we need to do the later actual shading. So instead of outputting colors, it might output its view space position and its normal or its material properties. And then we'll go and do a full screen quad for shading. We'll talk about that. So in the common case, a fragment shader just outputs a color, right? But you can do a lot more than that. That's what I want you guys to see. And this will become more concrete to when we look at the actual GLSL code. I feel that we're going through the pipeline in pretty good detail that, like, when we see the code, it's just going to be like so obvious to us. I hope so. I hope that's the case. Okay, so let's sum up the fragment shader section by looking at some fragment shader demos, again, in RenderMonkey. So I just have two examples here. This right here is NPR, non-photorealistic rendering. This is just a simple Gooch shader. And here, you know, you'll notice it's cartoon-like. And you'll see that it's really only got, you know, there's only a very small palette of colors here. And then you also notice the silhouette edges along where it's highlighting the black where the silhouette is, where the back face meets the front face. So this, does anyone know how to do this shading? What if I told you it's like one line of code? Who can tell me how to do it? The Gooch shading here, not the silhouette. I'll ask that next. This is just, go ahead. Specular? So in this, I don't think it's based on the specular component, but I think it's based on the diffuse component, where all they do is they take the diffuse intensity, which is that dot product of the normal, the surface normal, and then the vector to the light, and they just use that to look into a 1D texture that has your color ramp. Okay, and you'll see that done a lot, where we come up with some metric, and then we look into a color ramp to get the actual color. And instead of even looking up into a 1D texture, you could just say, well, if diffuse is greater than 0.65, say diffuse is 0 to 1, then use this color. Otherwise, use this other color. You can see things like that. In fact, let's look at their code, because I'm telling you how this works, and I haven't even looked at their code. But let's look at their code and see if I'm a liar or not. Yeah, okay, so the silhouette, that's a good question. So here, there's so many different ways to find silhouettes, and like none of them work perfectly. It's a total, I don't want to say it's a nightmare, but there's a lot of different techniques. The simplest technique is, yeah, when that normal changes from front facing to back facing, so when the surface normal and the viewer direction, when that dot product is zero, is at 90 degrees, you can say that's a silhouette. Right. Do you guys see that? You can also do, and you can do that in a fragment shader. You can also get silhouettes in screen space. You could do, you could pretend that you're Photoshop and you can do image processing to figure out where the silhouettes are. And with a depth buffer, it turns out, I don't think it's that hard. Or in a fragment shader, what you can do, in a vertex shader, you can render the object once, and then you render it a second time, but don't show the front-facing triangles, only the back-facing triangles, and expand them, scale them just a little bit, and then when you scale them, that back-facing part, it becomes the silhouettes. There's like, I can't tell you how many different ways to render silhouettes. There's a million of them. We have a student presentation on NPR, and they'll go into more detail, I hope, than I am, but it's definitely an interesting area. And they're useful way beyond just for like rendering style. Like a lot of times you might generate a silhouette texture and use it for other things.
What does NPR stand for?
NPR, non-photorealistic rendering. So instead of trying to do realistic looking rendering, you kind of want it to look cartoon-like to get that particular style. Let's take a quick look at their fragment shaders, see. Yeah, so here's what they're doing. They say they have a cool color and a warm color. And then when they mix them, they interpolate them, this N dot L here, that's N dot L is literally the diffuse component. So that is their, that's basically how they do the Gooch shading. It's pretty cool. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. I'm not positive, though. Okay, let's look at one other example here. Here's the glass. And if you guys haven't already, download RenderMonkey and take a look at all the stuff. All the different shaders they have. Okay, so this particular example is trying to show glass here. And does everyone see how it has a combination of reflection and refraction, meaning that it reflects the surrounding environment, kind of like a mirror would, but it also distorts it, kind of like if I were looking through, looking through water. So this thing does both reflection and refraction, and this is done in the fragment shader, using a technique called environment mapping, where a texture comes in here, but it's not just a 2D image. In fact, it's six 2D images that form a cube that is the environment. And we'll go over this in super detail, I think, later. But what it does is, a fragment shader executes for each part of the glass, and then it reflects the incoming vector. And we're going to do a whole class on like basic shading techniques is what I'm calling it, and in which case we'll go over probably things like this with actual code examples so you guys see how simple the code is, because right now I don't know if words alone are sufficient.
But you know, here's the glass. I'm looking at a fragment. It's got a normal. And then there's a vector to where the viewer is. I can reflect this vector. And I have this environment map that I pretend is out in infinity. I have this cube that's infinitely far away that has the image that I want to refract, that I want to read from. So I get this reflected vector, and then I read from this cube map. And then I also can take this vector and refract it underneath. And then I can read from this cube map. And then you can vary the reflection and refraction from the viewer angle. In fact, a lot of water, some simple water tricks are done like this. And we'll go over the code, like I said. I know this is just a quick example. We'll do the code after spring break. But one thing I want you to see is it really is only a few dot products and a few texture loops to do an approximation. And this is a total hack. Like, you could put anything in this environment map. It just so happens that their environment map looks like their surrounding area, but I could make this environment map like solid blue, and in which case this effect would be completely wrong. Because when you're in the fragment shader, you only have knowledge of your fragment and whatever data you pass in. You don't have your entire scene. So if you want to do refraction or reflection ray tracing style, where you bounce a ray back into your scene, well, you don't have your scene anymore. So here we kind of pretend that we have a scene, but why these six cubes? So any questions on the fragment shader? It creates colors. Yeah, the fragment comes in and colors it. Okay, so I want to go through now kind of the tail end of the pipeline. Well, a fragment needs to go through all these tests for it to become a pixel, for it to get written to the frame buffer. We've been talking about this thing called a depth test, and we'll look at that. But there's also some other tests. Do you guys have any ideas of other tests that might be useful? Okay, let's look. So there's three tests I want to talk about: the scissor test, stencil, and the depth test. The scissor test sounds like the most obvious thing in the world, and it is the most obvious thing in the world. But a scissor test allows us to say, I only want this fragment to continue going down the pipeline if it's within a particular rectangular region of the window. Do you guys have any idea why that would be useful? So it turns out that it's most often useful for performance. Imagine that I'm drawing a full screen quad, and in that quad I'm doing some extensive post-processing effect. So here's my window, and I'm drawing, when I say quad, I mean I'm drawing two triangles that are viewport aligned. They're really big triangles. And for each fragment, I'm going to do some expensive post-processing effect. But maybe, you know, I have my character. I really only want it to happen for that particular character. And I don't want to run the fragment shader all over here. So in that case, I can figure out this guy's bounding volume. I can project it onto the viewport. And I can use the scissor test to scissor it out so I don't have to compute anything out here. So the scissor test is almost always used for performance benefits so that I don't have to run the fragment shader. However, I'm showing it to you guys as if the scissor test happens after the fragment shader. That's why you're confused. I can't tell you how many people are confused in the world when they see this diagram. This diagram of this pipeline, this is a conceptual, logical series of stages. But they don't necessarily have to be implemented this way in hardware or if we were doing a software pipeline. A fragment shader, although it can change the depth value, it cannot change the XY position of the fragment. Therefore, the scissor test can be implemented before the fragment shader. Do you guys see that? Because the fragment shader will have no effect on it. Definitely write that down. So when NVIDIA and ATI, when they go to make their OpenGL pipelines or their GPUs,
performance runs the world, right? Like their drivers have to be as fast as possible. Their hardware has to be as fast as possible. So if they can put the scissor test before the fragment shader, they will. So they always do. Like it's the most. It's always done this way. And in fact, the scissor test could be done even before rasterization to some extent. In that, if you have a triangle and it's outside of your scissor and it's outside of your scissor region, you don't even have to rasterize it. Right, so you can move it way much earlier in the pipeline. Now, if your triangle overlaps your scissored region, then you have to rasterize some of it. Right. So it actually turns out to be pretty efficient having the scissor test in this pipeline. There was something called the alpha test that was in OpenGL. It just got deprecated like 4 years ago. But the alpha test would let you say, okay, if the output of the fragment shader, the alpha value is, you know, equals zero or is less than 0.5 or something, then discard the pixel. We'll get rid of the fragment. The thing is, we can do that in a fragment shader, right? We already said with that fence example for a game, we already said that we can do that. So they got rid of the alpha test because the alpha test happened later in the pipeline and had to happen later in the pipeline because the fragment shader could change alpha. When it's more efficient to do it in the fragment shader because you can do that early enough in your code that you don't have to run the rest of your fragment shader. So they actually got rid of the alpha test. The scissor test, however, I do not think they will get rid of in the near term, and definitely in the foreseeable future that I can see it, I don't think that they would deprecate this because it has such performance advantages because it can be done so early in the pipeline. Pretty cool. Pretty interesting. Okay. So like I say, this is typically done for performance to scissor out a region so that you're not doing extra fragment processing. So now, you know, for time's sake, I'm not going to hammer on the stencil test too hard. But have you guys heard of a stencil buffer or of the stencil test? No, you guys didn't do that at all?
All I've heard is something that you use it in deferred shading.
Use it in deferred shading? You can. Have you guys heard of shadow volumes? Did you guys see the shadow a little bit? I hear some. Okay. So the frame buffer we talked about, which is our ultimate goal here, usually we say the frame buffer is not just colors. It's not just pixels. It's multiple buffers that are of the same size and dimension. I'll say that for now. So not only does a frame buffer have what I'm now going to start calling the color buffer. These are all RGB values in the color buffer, maybe RGBA. But there's also a separate buffer called the stencil buffer. It's of the same size, you know, so this is 4x4. It doesn't store RGBAs. It stores 8-bit values. Typically 8-bit. I haven't seen a stencil, so that's really, you know, 0 to 255. I haven't seen a stencil buffer that was less bits or more bits, even on mobile. You know, like I have a Tegra 3 at my desk, and I'm always checking to see what the specs are on it. And even that has an 8-bit stencil buffer. I haven't seen something bigger than a 16-bit. The idea with the stencil test is I can draw something, and usually, this is always done with multi-pass rendering, where we draw multiple times. I can draw an object, like I said, I'll draw this triangle. And when I do that, I can modify the stencil buffer. I can increment, I have 0 to 255. I can set it to a certain value. I can say the stencil value is here, is 7. I can say it's 3, or I can say increment whatever's in the stencil, or decrement whatever's in the stencil. So I can say, okay, write to the stencil and write 1s. And this allows us to stencil out, literally. Think like when you're a kid and you have like a, you know, coloring book that you could stencil things with. This allows us to stencil out parts of the scene. And then in a later pass, you can draw with the stencil test and say, only draw when the stencil is 1. Only draw when the stencil is 0. Only draw when the stencil is not 1, and so on. So one example that people will say use the stencil buffer for is, say, you're playing a game and you want to have like, you know, night vision goggles, outline it. That's a really bad example of goggles. But here you might stencil everything here to be one, and you might stencil all of these to be zero right off the get-go. And then when you render your scene, you render it with a stencil test of one. All right, and this this is a decent example, and I'm not positive, but I think that the stencil test under many cases, but not all cases, can run before the fragment shader, in which case this is a performance win. Right, you guys see that, because as you render all your geometry, you won't have to shade things that are outside of here. But I think that there's other techniques that you can use to do this like goggles effects that would also perform well, that don't require the stencil test. So what is used for more often is stencil shadow volumes, which, let's see with time, yeah, we'll talk a little bit about stencil shadow volumes. Shadows are a huge deal, right, in computer graphics. I know you guys are probably familiar with shadows from a ray tracing point of view. From a rasterization point of view, they're like so much harder to deal with. And there's really two big areas that you see, two big techniques. One is shadow maps, and there are 1,000 variations. And one is called stencil shadow volumes. These were used in Doom 3. In fact, Carmack, he had definitely popularized these. I don't think he invented them, but he definitely popularized these. And he also invented a technique to make these more robust than the exact thing that I'm going to show you here. And what's interesting there is Creative Labs. You guys remember Sound Blaster? Do they still? I had a Sound Blaster in the mid-90s. Yeah, well, for me, it was just to get, back in the day, it was just to get any kind of sound out of your computer that wasn't a beep. I don't, they probably do, yeah, fancy 3D sound now. But the story goes that a variation of the stencil shadow volume that was more robust than the naive implementation I'm going to show you here was patented by Creative Labs. I don't know why Creative Labs would patent a shadow volume technique. They do, sound cards. But then turned out John Carmack from id Software, he also independently invented that same algorithm and had it published or had it known out in the community far before they actually did the patent. So therefore, there was prior art with the patent. So I don't think the patent actually holds. But it's just an interesting side story. Okay, so long story short, we're talking about the stencil buffer. We need an example so that we kind of see the motivation for a stencil buffer. So I bring up this idea of shadow volumes. And I want to tell you a little bit about shadow volumes so that we can see a good example for the stencil buffer. Probably the most popular example for the stencil buffer. Okay, so we care about when are objects in shadow, when are objects not in shadow. Right. Say I have this point light source that we see up there on the board, and I have some object, and I have some other object. This object is lit by that point light source, right? This object is in shadow because it's behind that object. Everyone sees that, right? It's pretty simple. So in the shadow volume technique, we extrude a shadow volume, which means from the point light source, we go around each object that can cast a shadow, and we make a shadow volume. That this is our 2D shadow volume. Okay. And now, let's just say the viewer is over here, and they're looking this way. Here's the screen. Here's the pixels that we're shading. If we were to trace a ray through a pixel and through the shadow volume, and say, here's another object back here to make it more interesting, and it matches that pixel. Say we trace this ray, and when we enter the shadow volume, we increment. When we exit the shadow volume, we decrement. We start with values in the stencil buffer at zero. Here we increment, decrement. Here I wind up with zero. Here I wind up with one. So and I don't have a proof because I don't do proofs, right? What you wind up with is if an object is in shadow,
its stencil is going to be non-zero. Okay, and this works even for overlapping shadow volumes. It works for all sorts of cases. So the idea here is now, how do we capitalize on this using the stencil buffer? And what you do is you render your scene with just ambient and emissive lighting. Okay, so that's just, you know, the global kind of lighting out there. But now for the diffuse and specular, what you do is you render all your shadow volumes just to the stencil buffer. And then when you render your scene, let me get my notes. This is complicated. You will not be responsible for how does the shadow volumes work. But I don't want to tell you the wrong thing, so let me just check my notes here. Yeah, sorry. So when you render these shadow volumes, you do it conceptually in two passes, where on the front, or when you render the front faces, you increment, and then you render again, and you render the back face, and you decrement. Now, that's conceptually two passes, but there's double-sided stencil and pretty much all OpenGL variations, which means that you actually do one draw call, but you configure it so that when on front faces you increment and on back faces you decrement, and that happens in one pass. And that feature was added for stencil shadow volumes. So now after you render the shadow volumes, your stencil will be non-zero for things that are in shadow. So now when you re-render your geometry, and on the value is non-zero. Yeah, anything that has a stencil of non-zero is now not in shadow, so you don't shade that with the diffuse and specular. Alright, so that's a horrible explanation for shadow volumes. Look at my notes, that's where it's better. But I want you guys to understand that there's another buffer next to the color buffer, that's a stencil buffer, and you can use that. You can do operations like increment and decrement, and then you can use the values, you can test your fragments against the values in the stencil buffer to do various techniques, and one of them is stencil shadow volumes. They are surprisingly hard to implement really robustly, like under all cases, because the volume itself may intersect the near plane or intersect the far plane. There's like a bunch of variations of them. It's hilarious because I've actually implemented these, and now I need to triple check my notes to tell them to you correctly. But let's get rolling past that. So here's an example of Doom 3. Doom 3 was probably, yep.
Is it finding shadow volume performance intensive, or is it?
Yeah, that's a whole other discussion. So he's asking about the actual geometry of the volume itself, because I said, hey, we have to know where the point light source is, we have to extrude the volume. Yeah, so when this point, when this light source moves, or when this object moves, yeah, you have to recompute the shadow volume. I think that some people do, you may be able to do it in a vertex shader, but people also do it in what's called a geometry shader, which we'll get to soon in the slides, where on the GPU, they can figure out where the silhouette is from the perspective of the light source, and then extrude geometry and create new geometry all on the video card. Other questions about stencil shadow volumes? Okay, so the most important test in all the per fragment tests is the depth test. Okay, and this is finally what fragments are in front of what other fragments. This is solving the visible surfaces. How do we know what finally makes it to the frame buffer and what is discarded and what is not in front of what? And this is the brute force obvious thing that you could think of, where from the viewer's perspective, every fragment has a depth value, we'll say between 0 and 1, which is the most common case. And as you're drawing new fragments, as you're creating new fragments, if your depth value is smaller than the current fragment in the frame buffer, or the current pixel in the frame buffer, then you win the depth test. Right? That's a less than depth test. You can do less than equal to. You can actually configure this, so you could use any operation you want. But most commonly, it's just, what's my depth value? Am I closer than the pixel in the frame buffer? Yes, then I win. No, then, ignore me.
So here's an example. This is actually an image from my virtual globe book. Here's some terrain that I've shaded based on the slope of the terrain. You'll see how it's really like glowing where it's really steep. And then also, you'll see these contour lines. They're actually procedurally generated in the fragment shader. So the fragment shader, I mean, it's expensive, but it's not super expensive. But here, obviously, right, lower and closer to us. Down the bottom of the scene, those mountains are closer to us than the ones farther away. So here's what a depth buffer looks like. Right, we're black near zero. These fragments are closer to us, so then as you go up, you can see you get closer away. Those fragments are farther away. So I want you really to be able to visualize that. Okay, so here's the kicker, though. This depth test, does this need to be after the fragment shader? We said the scissor test doesn't need to be after fragment shader. The stencil test, I believe, and I won't ask you anything about the stencil test in any of your homeworks, but the stencil test, or anything in terms of where it is in the pipeline, I believe that under most cases, the stencil test can run before the fragment shader, although I'd have to confirm that. But I'm pretty sure that's the case. And the depth test, can that run before or after the fragment shader? Come again?
Both.
So you say both. When can it run before the fragment shader? You said that it could run in either case, the depth test?
Yeah.
Okay. So you think that it could it always run before the fragment shader?
You said previously fragment shader changed the depth value.
So right. So if the fragment shader can change the depth value, we can't run the depth test before the fragment shader, right? But if your fragment shader doesn't change the depth value, then we can. And we call this optimization early Z. So sometimes you might see, if you Google early Z. So any video card today, it will go. Does your fragment shader discard or change depth value? Oh, it doesn't. Great. I'm going to do the depth test earlier in the pipeline. So it's a very common optimization that's done. And there's actually things that we can do in software to help the have more pixels fail the depth test, or more fragments fail the depth test. And you can imagine one simple thing is that you render your scene front to back, right? So now, later in the scene, those objects that are behind behind the front guys, they're discarded right away, right? And you can do a really coarse sorting. And there's 100 techniques, actually, along those lines. And we'll get to some of them after spring break. Okay, so that's about it for the per fragment test. Like I said, there used to be something called the alpha test, but now with fragment shaders, that's gone away. Okay, so let's look a little bit at blending to kind of finish up our pipeline. I actually had no idea that it would take almost two lectures because we haven't even talked about mapping this to hardware. I know I have been putting in a lot of tidbits about OpenGL and the hardware, but I haven't fully showed you the hardware stuff yet, which I want to get to. But okay, so a fragment, we shade it, it gets through all these tests, and we're just about ready to run it to the frame buffer. Now there's a stage called blending. Okay, and what it lets us do is that the fragment that is coming out of the fragment shader is about to go to the frame buffer. Blending allows us to look at that fragment and the pixel in the frame buffer, and it allows us to combine them. Okay, we can add them, we can subtract them, we can have coefficients that we multiply each one against. So for example, we might take the alpha value of the source fragment, which is coming out of the fragment shader. We might multiply that by the source fragment, and we might do 1 minus the alpha, multiply that by the frame buffer pixel, and we might add them, we might subtract them. We can do a lot of different things. Do you guys have any ideas why we'd want to do this? Blending? So, no ray tracing, because as you guys will see, ray tracing is just so easy, everything. Don't quote me on that, that'd be a horrible thing to say, but ray tracing makes so many things really easy, right? So to do translucent objects in ray tracing, it's pretty easy, right? You trace your ray from front to back, and you can kind of accumulate opacity, right? How do we do translucency in rasterization? And you guys, everyone knows what a translucent object is, right? It's like you can partially see through it. Think like that.
You can keep the alpha value as one and then put what is behind it.
So you're kind of saying add, just keep adding to that pixel. Don't replace the pixel in the frame buffer. Keep adding your color on top of it. Right. Okay, so that is called additive blending, and that is a valid way to do translucency. It looks so bad, though. Why does it look so bad?
Because you don't have any fallout for things that are behind translucency.
So, okay, so that's a big detail I completely left out. What you do is, in rasterization, you render all your opaque objects first, and then you render your translucent objects. So this way, your translucent objects will blend with the opaque ones, right? But additive blending will saturate at one. It will saturate at the maximum color really quickly, and you'll wind up with like this you know, kind of whitish kind of scene, right? But additive blending is really fast. The alternative is what they call alpha blending, which I kind of described in words here. But so we already said additive blending. Look at this, you know, it's just an add. Here's the destination, that's the color in the frame buffer. Here's the color that's coming out of our fragment shader. And we'll multiply by the alpha, which is a measure of opacity. Say it's between 0 and 1, where 1 is opaque, 0 is transparent. Now, in fact, you don't even need to do this multiplying here, because you can do what's called pre-multiplied alpha. And before you even, and like if this were coming from a texture, for example, if that RGB was from a texture read, you would pre-multiply that alpha before you even create the texture. Now, there's something called alpha blending, where we use this source alpha value, but we take 1 minus that from the destination value. So this way, we're not continuing to accumulate opacity. We're kind of penalizing things that are already in the fragment, already in the frame buffer. The thing is, to get this right alpha blending, you have to render the scene from back to front. So you have to sort all of your objects that are translucent. You render all your opaque objects, and then you render all your translucent objects back to front. And that way, the alpha blending is correct, right? Because you see the 1 minus there. And that sucks, because sorting is expensive, and it's slow. And we have to do it on the CPU. So we will, you know, I've decided on the hot topic. Last year, I said the hot topic was screen space ambient occlusion, and we talked about that in class. This year, the hot topic is going to be order-independent translucency, and in general, multi-fragment effects. So how can we do this translucency without having to do all this sorting and alpha blending on the CPU? How do we push it all into the video card? And there's so much work being done in this area that I think it will be really interesting for you guys to see it, and it's definitely very up and coming, so it'd be pretty cool. Okay, so we blend. Finally, we're done. We walked through the frame book. It took us 2.5 hours. We got through the crashes pipeline. What questions do you guys have about going through this graphics pipeline? Any fundamental questions? You know, no question is too simple. We want everyone to be with us here. A bunch of vertices come in, they get transformed, they get reassembled into triangles or primitives in general. They're rasterized, and the values are interpolated and put into the fragment shader. Color is produced. They go through a series of tests to see if they're allowed to continue, and then they're finally blended with the frame buffer. This pipeline here is very, very close to the OpenGL ES2 pipeline. OpenGL ES2 is OpenGL for embedded systems. It's what runs the graphics on all of your phones. It's also what is powering WebGL. It is a great pipeline because if you know how to use it, you can hit so many different platforms in so many different areas. We will look a little bit at a more, and this is also very similar to OpenGL 2, which is desktop version OpenGL 2. We'll look a little bit at OpenGL 3 pipeline, and even with the student presentation, we'll look a little bit at the OpenGL 4 pipeline, and we'll see how this thing continues to evolve, continues to get bigger and bigger, and we'll even talk about how we think it's going to continue. Okay, so now that we've seen this pipeline, let's talk about actually putting this in hardware. Right, we're familiar with the G80 from our CUDA discussions. But let's see how we got to the GAE. So, although this is not the original start of computer graphics, on the PC, this is really where, you know, commodity 3D graphics became popular. This was with Ed's games, Wolfenstein in 92 and Doom in 93. These were not done with GPUs. These are all software rendered, all done in software. And these things ran Wolfenstein 3D. I could have sworn I ran that off a 3.5-inch floppy disk on a 286. I think a 286 is like 16 megahertz or 20 megahertz. Like, it was really slow when I used to play that game. Yet it was interactive. It rendered at, I believe, 320 by 200 resolution. It did, you know, these 3D graphics. It had collision detection with the character. The enemies had artificial intelligence. It ran really well. Now look at the graphics. Look at it on the left hand side. First, the floor and the ceiling. They're a constant color, right? Look at the enemies, look at the pillars. They're always facing the viewer. Those are literally, they're 2D sprites that always face the viewer. When you look at the walls, you couldn't have like truly rolling curved walls. Like, it was, the world was 2.5D. It was a 2D map, and then for each value in that grid, it would say, you know, this has a wall, this has a pillar, this has this or that. And they were able to get really good performance even in straight on a seat on an old CPU. It was phenomenal. Like, this really, they actually did do it did 3D games before this, before Wolfenstein, where they started to develop the algorithms for this. But I think it became really popular with Wolfenstein. And then soon after that came Doom. Now Doom really made, it was still all done in software, but it really, had a lot more techniques compared to Wolfenstein. So look, Wolfenstein, it's all the same color, right? Don't let, you know, these white spots right here, they're supposed to be coming off of the chandeliers, don't let those fool you, right? There's actually no dynamic light in that in Wolfenstein, whereas there is some dynamic light in Doom, right? As well as you could actually have things in the scene that would move up and down, like elevators. The walls could curve. There was quite a bit of advancement done in Doom. Did you guys ever play these games? You guys were probably like born.
You couldn't have balconies or overgrades.
And Wolfenstein?
Yeah, Doom, right?
And
because everything was like displacement map
on
the floor.
Yeah, right. So there was only one height for any given XY, but that height could vary. Yeah, exactly. I don't know, you guys. Like, I grew up and I was in like, I used to play this game like in eighth grade. I don't know, so you guys were probably like in kindergarten or something when you guys had these. But again, you know, this is all software, really optimized software, before we had GPUs, right? So, you know, what people started saying, well, you know, how can we make graphics really fast? How can we really start pushing the level of realism in our graphics? Because the game industry, you know, really wants, is really driving that and has been driving for a long time. So it turns out that there's parallelism everywhere in graphics, right? And as we've seen with the G80, there's parallelism everywhere in the GPU, right? No coincidence here. So they started looking at this graphics pipeline and we go, oh, geez, well, for one thing, it's pipeline parallel, meaning when I put a triangle into that pipeline, I don't have to wait for that triangle to go all the way through that pipeline before I can put another triangle in. Right, I can. It's just like a pipeline for instructions. I can keep pumping in one triangle, another triangle, another triangle. It's also data parallel. We didn't explicitly say this, but I think it was fairly obvious to you guys. But that vertex shader and the fragment shader, they can all run in parallel. Like, no vertex depends on another vertex. So two vertices can go down the same vertex shader at the same time. Just think in CUDA, you know, you're running your multiple threads. Each vertex is handled in one thread. Okay, same for a fragment shader. Each fragment, separate thread. Right, so they're data parallel, just like all the other things that we've seen in CUDA. Even rasterization, I can rasterize two triangles at the same time, right? Now, at some points in the pipeline, I want me to sync. Like, for example, the depth test, right? I'm going to need to sync that because I can't just randomly write to the frame buffer. I need to kind of I need to merge at some points in the pipeline. And we'll also talk later in the semester about balancing this pipeline. You know, what do you do? You just go, okay, I'll split the screen up. Here's the left-hand side, here's the right-hand side, and I'll just throw triangles, you know, depending on which part of the scene a triangle overlaps, I'll throw down that pipeline. That's called sort first. Or you might, after rasterization, you might decide where fragments should go. We'll talk about those architectures because they're different on the desktop and mobile, which means that we actually need different optimizations as developers. So we recognize that the graphics pipeline is data parallel. We recognize that it's pipeline parallel. And we recognize that if we made hardware, a separate coprocessor for the CPU, that we could have the CPU and the GPU executing in parallel, which means I'm on the CPU and I say, okay, go draw this scene, push all these triangles down this pipeline. I don't have to wait for that to finish before I start continuing doing like my AI work or my physics or collision detection. So you kind of have parallelism all over the place, right? And the GPU, you know, is, think of it as a coprocessor, right? It's a separate processor and it's executing in parallel with the CPU. And in addition to all this, another benefit of doing graphics in hardware was that we would burn certain algorithms like texture filtering. If I'm going to read from a texture, I might not just read one texel or one pixel from that. I might read multiple pixels and blend them together, and that's called texture filtering. Rasterization, we said we can burn those algorithms are burned into hardware. You know, multiply add, I believe that those instructions are on CPUs now, but multiply add and square roots, all these things that are common for graphics we burn into hardware. Texture filtering, by the way, that is really efficiently done in hardware. In fact, there was Intel Larrabee. You guys heard of Larrabee to some extent, right? Maybe three or four years ago, they made a big splash. And Intel Larrabee tried to do as much of the rendering pipeline in software as possible. But one thing that they didn't do in software was texture and filtering, because even though, you know, they had a G80 type architecture, although it was based on x86, texture filtering was something like 30 times faster if they just had it in fixed function hardware instead of them making it programmable. So there's lots of motivations for us to start building GPUs. Okay, so we'll start the history here, and then we'll finish it on probably Wednesday, actually, because I want to talk about your projects next Wednesday. So 3DFX made a Voodoo card. Did anyone have the Voodoo cards? No? So these are like probably one of the first cards that came out for the PC. And what they did was they took the back end of the pipeline that we've seen, rasterization, okay? You have a triangle, find out what fragments it covers. Fragment shading, but for them, fragment shading is not per fragment lighting, like we've been talking about. It's really like read a texture and output. It's very simple. Depth testing was in hardware, so just the back end, a very simplified version of the back end of the pipeline was done in hardware. But we were still doing vertex shading in software, okay? But like we observed earlier, for most scenes, we probably have a lot more fragments than vertices. This thing only had 4 to 6 meg of memory. A high-end Tesla card, the NVIDIA GPU, had 6 gig. And then the consumer graphics, the GeForce 580, I'm not sure. 2 gig, does anyone know of a card more than 2 gig? I wouldn't be surprised if there is one. But it's amazing to see how much memory. And this round, they're really... Go ahead.
I think you can get a GTX 590 with 3 gigs.
Yes.
It's actually just 2 580s on
one board. Gotcha. and this ran on a PCI bus, which is super slow. Okay, this is not PCI Express, PCI. So, since we're just about out of time, let's stop our discussion of the history with Voodoo, but we'll pick up from here next Wednesday. And then next Monday, we'll have some student presentations and also talk a little bit about the course projects. So, I'll see you guys.